Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Mott's Weekend. Coming up this hour, psychologist and media consultant Dr. Oren Amatay responds to actor Sean Penn's contention that we're becoming indifferent to war crimes because we don't see enough real violence on television. Even our conversation about it had me a little uncomfortable.
My concern is you see it too often, and then you actually do become anesthetized to it. That's where he's off base. Number two, the flip side of that is even just watching videos can traumatize you.
If you're a government employee, this might traumatize you to some extent. Ted Mallett is chief economist with the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, who says your public sector counterpart does better than you.
In general, we found a wage advantage of between 3 and 13%.
That CFIB report, just one of many, that shows it's worth pursuing that government job. Being a politician can be profitable, but it may leave you unpopular. Jane Hilderman is director of research for Samara Canada, a group dedicated to improving Canadian democracy.
Only 40% of Canadians trust MPs and parties to do what is right.
And according to one politician, our transportation minister, if you find yourself bogged down in traffic during the Pan Am Games this summer, it's because you and other commuters failed to cooperate. Michael Harris, Tory transportation critic.
Hoping that traffic's going to be reduced by 20% during the peak hours by asking 1 in 5 people to stay out of the city or not go to work, I wouldn't say is a plan at all.
This and more coming up. Welcome to Mott's Weekend. According to actor Sean Penn, we're becoming anesthetized to war crimes because there's not enough violence on TV. Not the Hollywood kind of violence, but real violence. And that, he says, is why he forces himself to watch the ISIS beheading videos, to remind him of how savage real-life killings can be. Joining us now is psychologist and media consultant Dr. Oren Amatay. Hello there.
Hi.
So what do you say about this? Do we need to see the actual footage of war crimes to fully understand or appreciate how horrendous they are?
I don't think we have to. I understand in theory what he's saying, and you know, the reality is that all the government since the 60s, because of, I mean, he cites this, he says during the 60s war, you know, we saw on TV what was happening. And that is what led to a lot of the whole movement of doublespeak, where government started, you know, using different words. Instead of saying, you know, innocent civilians died, they used collateral damage. So there was a concerted effort to kind of, as he says, anesthetize the public to the horrors of war. But we don't actually have to see those horrible images. If we hear what's going on, if we know the truth, we don't have to see it. And that's where I think he's a bit off base.
But it's not quite the same thing. Hearing about it or seeing the Hollywood stuff is a lot different than seeing the actual act itself. I've seen some of the beheadings. Huge difference when you know it's real.
Oh, definitely. And my concern is twofold, though. If people do see it, there's two things. One, you see it too often, and then you actually do become anesthetized to it. That's where he's off base. You know, when you see real killings, if you see enough of them, you can become numb to them. And number two, the flip side of that is if you see just one or two, it's being shown. And in fact, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders has now changed their description of PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, saying that even just watching videos can traumatize you. Mm-hmm. There's now evidence. Even one of Canada's top forensic psychiatrists, now he watched quite a few of them. He's the one who watched the Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka videos, and he experienced PTSD. And he thought he was, like, he called himself the tough guy psychiatrist. He thought he had seen it all, and he broke. He actually suffered symptoms. So why would we risk, you know, causing other people to experience that? If they know how horrible it is, you know what, look at pictures. Even the pictures are horrific, but there's something different. And I've seen those beheadings as well. There's something different between seeing the pictures and actually watching this horrific act. And I'm worried about the effect it can have on people.
Okay, you've seen some of the beheadings, the actual videos. Is this something you'd want to see again and again?
No. And I saw the beheadings before the ISIS ones. I saw other ones years ago because in my job, you know, I've come face to face with evil, you know, all types of evil. And, you know, as part of my, I don't know, trying to understand how low we can go and what motivates people and so on, I have seen, whether through my own direction or unfortunately through my work, some terrible, terrible things. So I've seen the ISIS videos, but before then I saw, other beheadings, and I don't need to see any more. Mm-hmm. And but Sean Penn's right. I mean, if anyone says, I haven't been affected by it, he says, I think they're intellectually dishonest or existentially empty or not present or something like that.
I'd be worried about those people that don't have a reaction to it.
Yeah, that's really concerning if someone doesn't have a reaction. I mean, it is terrible. But again, why do people need to see that? I understand the point of getting across, but the other thing is, though, and this is where it kind of confounds me, if he's so concerned about this, then you know what? I want to hear him say that he's watching all these other types of videos that happen to people every single day, far more likely than a beheading, far more likely than terrorist actions. And I'm not going to mention all of them, but, you know, we know these things. Is he watching all these videos as well to remind him of himself of just how horrible people can be? Because if he's not, then he's being hypocritical.
But again, if our concern is people are going to become desensitized if they see the real thing again and again, you don't want to see them again. So you're not going to become desensitized, are you? I'm not going to see them again. Once was enough for me.
I know, but you could have kids coming across these things, showing friends. I just think that it would be awful. I did not watch them purposely, because just the thought of them sickens me.
Yeah, and you know what? There are websites. We know this, and they're flourishing. I mean, we can't tell the percentage of people who watch it and what kind of people watch it, but there are a lot of sites out there that show these videos, right? And the fact is, people are watching them over and over, and those people are becoming desensitized to it. And you could argue, is it just, you know, is it only psychopaths and sociopaths watching this? Or are quote-unquote normal people watching it, and, you know, they get pulled into it, and then, you know, over time, they start watching more and more gruesome things, and they become more and more desensitized. I'll tell you what, we have seen this happen in with pornography, where people, and it's a similar process. It's, what are you getting out of it? What kind of rewards is your brain getting from watching these things? And people, we know for a fact, when they're watching excessive pornography, they're driven to find more and more extreme forms. So I can see somebody watching a video of a fight between two people, and that gets pretty bad. Then they see another fight where there's more blood, and then they're going, I want more. And then, you know, they're wanting something more and more to kind of, you know, give them that hit, that dose, you know, that they were getting from just a simple fight. It's not enough anymore. So now they need more violence, and they can find themselves on these websites and again, becoming desensitized.
Dr. Oren Amate is on the line with a psychologist and media consultant at docamate.com. Now, Sean Penn is talking about us being desensitized to all of this. There's a political motivation. He's a very political guy there, too. And as he says, you know, when people see horrific things like this, initially they're motivated in some way, either make it stop. How are you going to make it stop? Does that mean you bomb the hell out of ISIS? Does that mean you try to negotiate with them? Which is clearly ridiculous, because if they're cutting off people's heads, it's not likely that you're going to talk to them very much.
He feels it's more likely if you see the real thing, it'll move you to take some kind of action.
Something. Yeah. And that is true, though, isn't it? It will motivate you to do something.
If you know it's real.
Yeah, but the question is, what are you going to do? And and research has actually shown that when people, I'll tell you right now, years ago, when they tried to get people, for example, to quit smoking, in the 1950s and 60s, when they were doing social psychology experiments, and they tried to scare people into doing things, if you are, you know, shown these terrible images, and with smoking they're showing, you know, lung disease and so on, but you're not given the tools to actually do something, then you start blocking it out. So what can a normal person do, a normal citizen do, when they see these things? There's very little that they can do aside from sign up, you know, and join the army, which, you know, happened after 9/11. But I don't know what this would really motivate people to do. So if people hear of these things, see these terrible images, and then they realize, practically speaking, there's nothing that I can do to deal with this, then they start shutting it out. It actually is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I saw this beheading, it kind of took me by surprise. I was checking up on the story, what's the latest, so on and so forth, and this still came up, and then I clicked on it, and it was the actual beheading. And while repulsive, it was also fascinating at the same time. I'm thinking, what is going through the minds of these people who are doing this? What are they thinking?
Right. You know what? We can't answer that. We can give a simplistic answer of they're not thinking anything because they're savages, or we can think that, you know, on a deeper level, they feel that they are just, they're righteous, they're doing the right thing, which I know, I mean, even Canadians, as we know, people are, you know, flocking to ISIS, certain types of people, and they're thinking, you know, the same kind of thing, that somehow they're justified in taking an innocent person and beheading them, whether it's soldiers, whether it's, you know, Japanese, you know, tourists, or, you know, people trying to help out. So, you know, I don't know what exactly they're thinking. It does, I mean, when I saw the videos as well, My mind was racing as to, you know, to a number of questions.
Like, who the hell does this?
Yeah, well, you know what? We can see, it depends. If they're trained from a very young age, and we know that this is the tactics that that they use with child soldiers, if you force someone to do something terrible at a young age to someone that you know, they go for family members, a pet, a good friend, when they force you to do that, once you've crossed that line, the mind has to try to cope with the fact that they've done something terrible. So the mind kind of then starts framing things in a way that makes them not feel like a terrible monster. They have to justify it. They have to dehumanize the person that they're doing it to. So, you can very easily train somebody from a young age to do these horrible things, but you also train them to lose their soul because the brain, you know, the normal person's brain cannot handle the fact that they've done something so terrible. So they have to twist it into ways that makes it more palatable for them. And so for people who are not raised in that capacity and they see these videos and somehow they feel that this is righteous and that they want to join in, that is extremely concerning. That's to me a bigger concern.
But prior to these atrocities, the guillotine or some guy with a samurai sword, and it was very quick. This is a long, drawn-out process sawing. No, hang on a second, Carol.
I don't think you need to really go through the whole process.
It's not a quick procedure.
No, it's not. And I know I can hear Carol's unease with this. It's not quick. It's not clean. And if you have volume, because these videos also have volume, that's part of the most, you know, perhaps the most disturbing thing is the sound effects. That's what I'm saying. This can truly traumatize people watching it, which is why I don't see the merit in forcing people to watch it. Fortunately, again, I'm able to compartmentalize, I'm able to put it aside, but, you know, I was touched in that moment, and like I said, I am just really worried that some people will become traumatized. We know that it can happen just from watching these videos, because they are some of the most terrible things we've ever seen. Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you something else, because you said once they've crossed that line, they've learned how to justify what they've done. We've got a 17-year-old that was just recently charged. What happens to young people like that? Is it possible to bring them back to the other side of the line again with the rest of the world?
It is possible. It's very, very difficult because, I mean, there is one child soldier from Africa, and I forget which country, a few years ago. He wrote a book. He toured the country. On his own, he brought himself back. So we know that it is possible. The problem is to bring them back, you have to help them confront what they really did. And once if you reclaim your humanity and you realize the atrocities you've committed, that can lead to such potentially post-traumatic effects because you've engaged in a trauma or a terrible thing. And so it's a very difficult, challenging process. And it is possible, but I don't envy anybody, you know, who would have to go through that.
And no offense, but when someone in your profession says, okay, we've treated this individual, they're good to go, I don't have a whole lot of faith in that. I'm sorry.
If somebody were, for example, arrested and we want to see could they be released, when someone is psychotic and, you know, and they have a mental disorder like schizophrenia, they're truly psychotic, they lost touch with reality, they're taking their medications, and we know it has nothing to do with who they are, but because they lost their mind temporarily, I'm more willing to say as long as they're on their medication, we have safeguards, that's one thing. But when somebody has done these things of their own volition or they were forced to do it and they did it repeatedly and that's become now part of their mental structure, I agree with you. I mean, I don't know what kind of safeguards could help ensure that they're not going to do something again. They're not going to be triggered. They're not going to regress back into that savage state that that they've been living in. So your concerns are well-founded.
So bottom line is we don't want to see these things because it's going to do an awful lot of damage to all of us.
It can, and one way or the other. Like I said, either if you become desensitized after watching it, which again is contradictory to what Sean Penn believes, but if you do after repeated viewings, that's one thing. Or once again, you get traumatized by it. You really need to see it. But I don't think we should duck our heads and pretend it's not happening. That's the only part I agree with when he says we don't want political correctness to prevent us from acknowledging just how horrible this is. Because I deal with reality when I deal with my patients. Whether it's a small thing or a huge thing like this, I don't want people to pretend that reality is different than what it is. We are seeing what reality is, at least with these people, we have to, we can't pretend that they're anything other than what they are.
Dr. Oren Amate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
And that's psychologist Dr. Oren Amate from docamate.com. And joining us now for another segment of Parnaby's Perspective is broadcast journalist Taylor Parnaby. Hello there.
How are you?
Good.
Are you enjoying the warm weather?
I am. I don't like all the muck and the rain and the rain snow and the...
Carol, I think he's being sarcastic.
But I do like the warmer weather. No, we've had a few good days. We have, and I enjoyed them.
Well, it is warmer.
If it wasn't for the muck, we'd have nothing more to complain about, right?
That's right. But then we could turn to politics. Let's start with our expanded military mission in the Middle East. The Prime Minister announcing that we're going to broaden our airstrikes into Syria and extend our involvement over there by at least a year.
I'm so tired of being conned by the cons in Ottawa. Tired of the process. I'm sure that if the full understanding of the problems were understood by Canadians, they would be much more leery about extending Canada's mission to Iraq and Syria. I don't think the Conservative government of Canada understands the importance of being forthright and honest with the country. They believe in being forthright and honest with their own political prospects and going to the polls having convinced the country that they are at risk, a real and imminent risk. Therefore, we should be virtually at war, I think, is dishonest. If we had a full understanding of what the problems are and the extent of them, we might have a different view than we apparently are expressing now. The view that we are expressing now has been carefully cultured by the conservative political machine, not by events in the Far East.
Let's take a look at another terrible situation. This co-pilot of the German airliner crashed into the Alps and apparently locked the pilot out of the cockpit, caused the plane to crash, did it deliberately, took all of these people to their death. And we hear, there was screaming. You can just imagine what was going on in that plane. Just horrific.
Yeah. I'm sure the first thing that went through your mind, first thing that went through my mind was the question of, was this a terrorist incident?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I reminded what I was taught by a chief coroner of the province of Ontario. Be careful of first impressions and first conclusions, because most often they turn out not to be so.
Looks like it was suicide, but obviously suicide in a very, very big way, taking all of these people with you.
That's what it seemed to be. I think I'll wait till they get the rest of the... Mm-hmm. of the data off that voice recorder, and if they can find the digital recorder indicating the character of the aircraft and what happened physically to the aircraft, I think we'll be a little closer to a more precise understanding of what's going on.
I was reading something, though, where this particular pilot had suffered burnout some 6 years ago, had suffered a depression. Obviously, we're going to read a lot of things about this, but was there anything... Was there anything since then? Anything that might tip people off as to strange behavior? Does that mean that if someone's ever suffered a depression of any kind, they can never be in a position of responsibility?
That's a good question.
I don't understand much of that. I really don't, and that's an honest answer. What I am going to suggest is that there's apparently a European-wide investigation into this, and I'm going to wait until they get through what will be very detailed investigation, coupled with investigations that the airline industry must feel compelled to undertake before I draw too many conclusions about who qualifies for what and what procedures should be for why.
Right. Taylor Parnaby is on the line with us with another edition of Parnaby's Perspective. Okay, how about those Toronto Maple Leafs?
Oh, goodness. There are symbols about things. Leafs out, not a meaningful game to be played in the entire month of March. The Raptors, I think they'll get to the playoffs, but I think they'll wilt in the first round. The Blue Jays, I don't think they'll play a significant game this September, let alone October. And this is the fourth wealthiest city in North America, which sports concrete crumbling from the Gardiner Expressway.
Still,
kerosene leaks leaking into an overwhelmed subway system. Too little space for too many people. Where you can't move a derelict ship from a waterfront, where homeless people die in the streets when it gets cold, and Toronto has the lowest municipal taxes in the GTA.
It's not only our sports teams that are falling apart.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the ownership of the Leafs have enjoyed a bonanza. It's a $1 billion sports enterprise, but last week, only $18,000 for one game.
Yeah.
So there's an expert in Australia or New Zealand who's an expert in the fan relationship with sports teams.
Mm-hmm.
He says, once it turns, it becomes technically catastrophic. And I think the turn is being made now by the public at large. I don't know what the TV ratings are, but I haven't watched a game in months now.
Well, the ratings are down.
Yeah, ratings are down. The scalpers can't give tickets away. And for the first time, I guess, Paul, you were telling me this, the Leafs on last Saturday, they were not the marquee team on Hockey Night in Canada. They were relegated to TSN.
Yeah.
You say to somebody, in the old days, you said you were a Maple Leaf fan. People got, oh, wow, I am too. Great. Let's have a conversation. Today, you get a raised eyebrow. You are?
Thank you, Taylor Parnaby.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Taylor Parnaby with Parnaby's Perspective. Skyrocketing energy costs are a sad fact of life these days.
Hi, we're the Motts for Magic Window, the window that far exceeds the Energy Star rating.
With its innovative technologies, including the Never Sag frame,
hide and slide screens,
a high security rating with hidden locks and latches,
easy to clean, and best in the business 40-year warranty, you won't want to miss it at the National Home Show at the Direct Energy Center.
Or go to magicwindow.ca, then call 866-OK-MAGIC.
The Magic Window. The engineering is brilliant.
The performance is magic.
If it hurts here when you get up in the morning,
or is a little stiff there after your workout,
you might be in need of a little kneading.
And need to check out the soothing line of products at themassagepro.com.
From the Massage Pro 3D Space Capsule, yes, there is a heaven.
To the Massage Pro 3D Head Massager, there's a massage product to meet your needs.
You'll no longer need that bony-fingered masseuse.
Visit themassagepro.com.
Call 1-519-756-5050.
Themassagepro.com. Here's to a pain-free 2015.
If you're a small business that would like to sound like a big one, you need Voicemail Tell.
Voicemail Tell is a cost-effective phone provider for toll-free, local, and fax numbers. It can reduce your cell phone bills, too.
It's important that your customers can get in touch with you. From $14.99 a month, Voicemail Tell gives you a more professional-sounding business without additional equipment or software.
Check them out online at voicemailtell.com or call toll-free 866-686-4236.
Grow your business and be in touch anywhere in the world.
Hi, I'm Carolyn of Bold Canine, a proud sponsor of The Motts Show. We look after all your dog's needs, from training to our full line of Bold raw food. Everything you need for your dog, you'll find with us. With stores across Ontario carrying our natural raw food for dogs and cats, we've made it convenient for you to feed your best friend what's best for them.
At Bold Canine, they love their dogs and they love yours too. Check them out at boldcanine.com or call toll-free anywhere in North America. 1-888-BOLD-K9.
If we don't see a 20% drop in traffic during this summer's Pan Am Games, then the GTHA will face greater gridlock. That from Transportation Minister Steve Del Duca, who seems to be suggesting that if traffic is hell, it's going to be our fault. MPP Michael Harris is the Tory transportation critic. He's joining us now. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
So how do you respond to Mr. Del Duca's statement?
Well, I mean, they announced it just the other day that this was their plan, but I'm not really sure if I'd call it a plan. You know, presuming that, you know, or hoping that traffic's going to be reduced by 20% during the peak hours by basically asking, you know, one in five people to stay out of the city or not go to work, I wouldn't say is a plan at all. You know, the capital of the province, Toronto, can't just shut down for the games. It's concerning.
So again, he is saying that if we face gridlock hell during these games, it's our fault because we didn't cut back enough.
Well, he's saying that their plan to deal with additional traffic due to the games is basically asking one in five coming downtown to stay at home. You know, bunker down, stock up on some supplies, and check the app that they're going to create. That's not a plan. I'll draw your attention to the London games. There, the actual government negotiated with companies to adjust workers' hours, to ease up rush hour concerns. I mentioned this week that, you know, the government is one of the largest employers in the GTA, and if the minister wants to take real action, he should move government shifts up 1 hour during the games or back, so you'd have a, you know, an earlier start time or a later start time. You know what? That could amount to tens of thousands of employees. I've not spoke to one company that, in fact, has been contacted by the government or the organizers of the games to do this. And I think that would be a plan rather than hoping one in five stay at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yes. Actually, that's a really great idea.
It is a good idea.
That's thinking, though, that most of the activities are going to happen during those peak gridlock periods. Is that the way it's going to lay out?
Well, look, at there's no doubt that the games are spread out throughout the GTHA and other communities and not all downtown. But don't forget, the athletes are all going to live downtown. You know what? We have to assume that, you know what, rush hour is going to be one of the busiest times. You know, look at what happened this week in Toronto. Major delays on the subway lines, on the Yonge Line, you know, causing traffic to be chaos in the inner city streets.
Yeah.
a major accident on the Gardner shutting down traffic just the other night, both all three lanes eastbound. The 401 truck rollover shutting the 401 down. That was on an actual good day. These things happen. Now add the Pan Am game traffic. And so, you know, to basically, again, say to for one out of every five people, stay at home or check an app before you leave, isn't a plan to address the additional traffic that's going to come into the city.
I would just think, though, that many people could telecommute. You know, things have changed so much now with technology as it is. A lot of people can work from home, so that might really be an option, and that could take a lot of people off the roads during that period of time.
You're right. It could, and it can, but why not actually start going to employers to negotiate this and get some hard numbers? Having faith in one in five to stay at home isn't a plan. It's a wish. You know, Ontarians have invested $61 million into transportation and planning. You know, I would have hoped that they could have come up with something better than an app and, an ask of Ontarians here. I will have to also address the fact that the plan doesn't account for municipal streets and delays, only highways on provincial roads. You know, you have to leave the city municipal streets or use municipal streets when you're coming in. There's no plan to address that potential problem as well.
MPP Michael Harris is on the line with us. He's the Tory transportation critic.
You know, Michael, if you're smart, you'll book your summer vacation during the games.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people will.
Just get the hell out of town.
Well, I'll be the first to admit it. I've got tickets for the opening ceremonies, and you know what? I'm thinking about how I'm going to try to get in from Kitchener already. I'll probably maybe take the train. You can't shut commerce down in the busiest city in Canada. You know what? Things have to happen still. And so that's why it's imperative that, you know, we actually go out like other game organizers have done, like London, and negotiate with companies, delivery companies, to see if there's a potential that they could do deliveries on off-peak hours, knowing that there will be significant delays. It's good for a company to do so, because they're going to be stuck in this mess potentially as well.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Just think, though, Michael, just think, if we still owned the 407, we could have opened that up and relieved the pressure, just made it free. Your government sold that.
Well, look, at the 407 is a great tool for folks to use. It's going to be readily available for participants, spectators to use, regardless on who owns it, I think that it's an important piece of infrastructure that will definitely be utilized during the games.
Well, I think the safest bet come the games is head for the cottage and watch them on television.
Well, you could do that, but it's not the same as being there. Michael,
I'm looking forward to getting out and getting to some of the sports. I'm a huge sports fan.
Me too.
Forward to the games. But at the end of the day, you know what? We need to be properly prepared. We've known about this for a long time. And we can learn from the lessons of other organizers and other jurisdictions.
Sure,
I just feel that we've perhaps not done that to the biggest degree.
Well, we thank you for sharing your thoughts on it with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks
for having
Michael.
Me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Michael Harris, PC Transportation Critic. It's not the first time we've heard this, but every time we do, it does ruffle the feathers a little bit. The Canadian Federation of Independent Business has released a new report that shows the average public sector worker is doing a fair bit better than his or her comparable counterparts in the private sector. Ted Mallett is the CFIB's chief economist. He's joining us now. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi.
So just how much better are public service workers doing? Give us some of the numbers here.
Well, we looked at a broad range of the public service, federal, provincial, municipal, even down to the education sector, the healthcare sector, and some of the other elements, public transit, Canada Post, and so on. There's a wide variety, and we're really trying to find the broad average. But of course, the average depends on what city you live in, what province, and so on and so forth. But, you know, in general, we found a wage advantage of, between 3 and 13% in the wages themselves, depending on the level of government. And if you expand the sort of the compensation measurement to broad hours of work as well as pension contributions by employers, then that can expand the total compensation benefit to between 18 and 30, over 30%.
Now, you're not the first to point this out. This has been going on for quite some time. There's been that gap.
I think there are some structural reasons why we tend to have higher wages in the public service. I think the kind of work that's being done is more highly concentrated. There's less turnover of employees. I think the bargaining approach, government is the only provider of public services of particular types and so on. And that means that if there's an interruption, we have had the occasional strike at the provincial level, federal level, and so on, municipal as well. There's tremendous political pressure to get people back to work and therefore the flowing of public services back. People don't like to see the interruption, and I think they're willing, during a strike, they're willing to say, hey, let's just get people back to work and try to pay for it later.
Because while they're out, it looks bad on us.
I think that's part of the issue, and mm-hmm. We've looked at this over the past number of years. We don't see a significant narrowing of the gap in time, but of course it is a challenge because we're looking at the census-related information, the National Household Survey. It only comes out every 5 years, and sometimes there's methodological changes in the data, so we're not really sure if there's some movement. It looks like the federal gap has shrunk a little bit, but we can't be sure if that's a real trend or whether it's just data noise causing that.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you saying? Are these, when you look at the wages of public sector workers, those are livable wages, those are good wages. Many people would like to get into the public sector for a variety of reasons, not just salary, but pension, stability, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. those things, rather than in the private sector. So what do you want? Do we want private sector wages to come up to meet public sector, or do we want to bring public sector wages down to meet private sector?
Well, it would be really nice if we could wave a wand and say, oh, everybody's wages can go up. Mm-hmm. Wages are kind of determined by the functioning of the economy, buying and selling of labor services, buying and selling of the products and services that a business produces. Businesses don't have a pot of money sitting around that they could just add to their wage bills. It has to come from the actual running of the business.
Yes.
And therefore it's a flow, not a stock. And the level of wages is determined really by the level of productivity or the output of the individual people who are, in various tasks and so on. We tend to have higher wages where there's, higher capabilities and higher productivity and lower wages and, at the lower levels. But so that's determined by the marketplace, as cold-hearted as it may sound. That's really where it comes from, and it can come from nowhere else. So really what we're hoping is that ensuring that the government wage bill is determined really has more of the kind of the market fundamentals that help determine the gross levels. So, yes, we'd love to see wages come up in that case, but it means that businesses have to be more successful, selling more products and services and so on. But that can't come from simply injecting money into wages.
Ted Mallett is on the line with us. He's the Canadian Federation of Independent Business Chief Economist. So if you went the other way then and you brought some of the public sector salaries down a little bit, brought them in line with private sector, what would that do in terms of, I guess, the people who pay the bills, the taxpayers? How much would be saved?
Well, we come up with a conservative estimate of about $20 billion is paid in the public sector, in and above what they would be earning if using private sector norms. Mm-hmm. In that case, that's a pretty big number. But of course, most of that is a redistribution. If we're not suggesting that public sector salaries are dropped or cut by that particular amount of money. Our recommendation is that it probably took an awful long time for those situations to develop over time. Let's start finding gradual ways to narrow the gap, maybe keeping wage level growth to inflation in the public sector as opposed to adding, the extra 1 or 2% that we tend to see at bargaining time. And as well, just make it very clear about, what are we getting for particular payments in the mm-hmm. public service. So, appropriate staffing levels and so on would probably help as well. But, there would be greater buying power in the private sector. There would be, additional spending and so on, which would help the general economy as well. But we'd have a general sense of more balance within the economy so that people performing equal tasks would more or less be paid the same amount of money.
But again, as a politician, if you're looking to cut in the public sector, you got to be very careful how you do this, because then your job's on the line.
Well, it works. But, I mean, the government's caught in the middle. Certainly, they're employers, but they're also looking for votes and re-election time and so
yes.
on. So it's a particular challenge for governments to manage this sort of thing. I wish politicians well. It's not an easy job, and I do respect the kind of task that they put in front of them. But they have to manage the health of the economy, not just the way that government functions. And part of the problems that we've had in terms of affordability of taxation and so on is stemmed from the relative high costs of running public services. It could be that we could probably be a little more efficient with the way that we run government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can look at the Toronto District School Board and the mess they're in at the moment. And now they're saying that they can save a substantial amount of money by just not hiring. When somebody retires, don't fill that position.
Well, I think we have, where the easy decision is just to, maybe in the past have been, well, let's just raise taxes a little bit. We'll grab another 1 or 2% here and there. Gradually that begins to wear on the taxpayer. It wears on the business community because it's a disincentive to actually invest and grow the business. And we're all worse off. It's very hard to kind of measure that kind of lack of potential because, how do you measure something that's not there anymore? We don't have a time machine to go back and change our policies over time, just hopefully generate a sort of a better economy. But we really want to make sure that we've got a well functioning public service, one that's reasonably priced, one that's tied to what the fundamentals of the rest of the economy is doing, and hopefully we'll be able to move appropriately with that.
So what becomes of this report now?
We've done this report now six times over the past 25, 30 years, and we get a lot of attention every time we come out with it. Who knows? I hope that we'll have some movement, if it only means a 0.5% or a 1% change in towards affordability, then I guess that's benefited some people somewhere. It could well be in a particular city, in British Columbia, or it could be the federal government in its negotiations with its public sector right now, or it could be one of the major provinces. So we don't know which government would take this information to heart. We hope they all look at it carefully, and hopefully we generate more discussion about it, better forms of measurement. I mean, we say that it's not an easy task. The data that we're using is not perfect by any stretch. We're looking at broad averages, and of course there's lots of exceptions on both sides. But let's find better ways of measuring so that we can come up with, it would be nice to have a consensus, but let's find where the majority view is.
Well, listen, we thank you for the report. This is information we should have, but as Carol said off the top, it annoys the hell out of a lot of people.
Well, it depends who you're working for. It depends
which
side of the fence you're on. But thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
And that was Ted Mallett, Chief Economist with the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. Skyrocketing energy costs are a sad fact of life these days.
Hi, we're the Motts for Magic Window, the window that far exceeds the Energy Star rating.
With its innovative technologies, including the never sag frame,
hide and slide screens,
a high security rating with hidden locks and latches,
easy to clean, and best in the business 40-year warranty, you won't want to miss it at the National Home Show at the Direct Energy Center.
Or go to magicwindow.ca, then call 866-OK-MAGIC.
The Magic Window. The engineering is brilliant.
The performance is magic.
If it hurts here when you get up in the morning,
or is a little stiff there after your workout,
you might be in need of a little kneading.
And need to check out the soothing line of products at the MassagePro.com.
From the Massage Pro 3D Space Capsule, yes, there is a heaven,
to the Massage Pro 3D Head Massager, there's a massage product to meet your needs.
You'll no longer need that bony-fingered masseuse.
Visit themassagepro.com.
Call 1-519-756-5050.
Themassagepro.com. Here's to a pain-free 2015.
If you're a small business that would like to sound like a big one, you need Voicemail Tell.
Voicemail Tell is a cost-effective phone provider for toll-free local and fax numbers. It can reduce your cell phone bills, too.
It's important that your customers can get in touch with you. From $14.99 a month, Voicemail Tell gives you a more professional-sounding business without additional equipment or software.
Check them out online at voicemailtell.com or call toll-free 866-686-4236.
Grow your business and be in touch anywhere in the world.
Hi, I'm Carolyn of Bold Canine, a proud sponsor of The Mott Show. We look after all your dog's needs, from training to our full line of Bold raw food. Everything you need for your dog, you'll find with us. With stores across Ontario carrying our natural raw food for dogs and cats, we've made it convenient for you to feed your best friend what's best for them.
At Bold Canine, they love their dogs and they love yours too. Check them out at boldcanine.com or call toll-free anywhere in North America. 1-888-BOLD-CANINE.
According to a new survey by Samara Canada, a nonpartisan charitable group that works to improve Canadian democracy, we're not all warm and fuzzy when it comes to our politicians. Jane Hilderman is Samara's Director of Research and Acting Co-Director. She's on the line now. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So what does your report, Democracy 360, reveal? What do we think of our political public servants?
Well, we were looking at three facets of citizens' relationship to their political leaders. We looked at communication, participation, and how they think about the job that our political leaders are doing on our behalf. And overall, Samara issued a letter grade of C for this report card. So we're not failing. That's good news, but there are some cracks in our democratic foundation.
Okay, what are some of those cracks?
So we saw, in terms of how Canadians think about our political leaders, really quite low levels of trust. Only 40% of Canadians said that they had held some trust towards MPs and parties to do what is right. They also had very low marks when it came to the sort of core jobs that MPs and parties do. For an MP, in terms of representing constituents' views, they thought MPs did a much weaker job than, say, representing the views of their party. So right now, political leaders, in the eyes of Canadians, are certainly, letting them down. And as a result, we're seeing Canadians, I think, pull back from the political arena in terms of their participation levels.
Does it depend on the age of the individual? Did you find a certain demographic that was far more cynical than another?
We're going to be reissuing some of the data based by age, but in terms of the generational divide, right now that most clearly shows up at the voting booth. We know that Canadians aged 18 to 29 vote at far less the rate compared to their older cohorts, sometimes half the rate. So in 2011, those 18 to 29-year-olds were voting at 39%.
Mm-hmm.
And those aged over 65 to 75 were voting at 75%, vastly different. And that's a pretty worrisome trend because increasingly, research is pointing to the fact that voting is certainly a habit. So if you don't take an interest in getting involved in politics when you're younger, or I mean caring about politics, it might not translate into an activity you do later in life either.
Okay, we know our politicians are unpopular, but why are they unpopular specifically?
That's a great question. We think that in the minds of Canadians that they're just failing to do some of their core jobs is part of that story. What Canadians are finding is politicians are using talking points or not really speaking to issues that seem very relevant to the day-to-day lives of Canadians seems to be part of the problem.
But what about the scandals and the name-calling?
So our work didn't touch on scandals. And part of the challenge, I think, with scandals is that we know that they have a short effect, but aren't necessarily, it's hard to pull apart exactly their effect over the long term. I think that we're seeing a much more fundamental issue arise where fewer and fewer Canadians now are just tuning out of politics altogether, regardless of what's happening. And that's the sort of problem we want to draw attention to with this report.
Samara Canada's acting director, Jane Hilderman, is on the line with us, and we're talking about their report and why is it that Canadians seem to be more cynical. I thought it was interesting when it said 4 in 10 Canadians said they hadn't had a single political conversation in the past 12 months. I find that really hard to believe because so many, maybe they just don't recognize that it's a political discussion they're having because there are so many issues. If you're talking about, say, something to do with end-of-life decisions, well, that's a political discussion,
or
too.
Or involvement in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
I think you're absolutely right there. So Canadians may be talking about issues that are political, but if they don't see them as political, then it's very easy for them to think, you know, oh, politics doesn't affect me, or what decisions are being made by our elected officials, again, isn't that relevant. So we have a task to try to help connect those sort of issues to the political realm, I think, and make sure Canadians actually feel that they can have a voice that does get heard by political leaders.
I also wonder, too, when you have discussions like this, we have discussions like this all the time on the airwaves, and there is a lot of cynicism that comes in. How big a factor do you think the media is in heightening that cynicism?
That is a great point, because many people are concerned that often the negative stories are the ones that get the most attention.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think you're right, media probably has a story, but it's not the only factor, just in part because I think the media landscape is changing a great deal, and increasingly people no longer just turn to one channel for their news. They're getting it from all sorts of sources, and sometimes it's being curated by their friends and family through social media. So it's not quite a direct arrow anymore, but I agree that media is a main provider of information and thus has a very large role to play, particularly in an election year. When there's going to be more attention to the process of politics underway.
So what would you say about the state of democracy? Is it healthy?
You know, if you look internationally, and there are indices that rank Canada, we're always in the top 10. And that, you know, can make us feel pretty chuffed. But I think it's important to be reminded that democracy is not something to be taken for granted. It can slowly deteriorate if we're not involved, and citizens' involvement is what's really critical. We're starting to see some signs that we could do better, and our job, we like to think at Samara, is to help encourage people to think about their role in our democracy and hopefully feel spurred to get a bit more involved in the process.
So do you think that's happened since the report came out? What kind of reaction are you getting from politicians and other people? Obviously, we called you to talk about this. I'm sure you're getting calls from all kinds of outlets.
It's true. It's been very exciting. It's only 2 days, so it's hard to say the true impact. But it seems to be striking a chord, and that it's generating quite a lot of discussion. There was a debate yesterday evening on the topic, is politics broken? And interestingly enough, the yes side won resoundingly. So I think Canadians are recognizing this is a problem that maybe needs some more attention.
We got to fix it.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Jane Hilderman, Director of Research and Acting Co-Director at Samara Canada.
And that's it for this edition of Mott's Weekend. We do hope you enjoyed it. If you have a comment, like always, love to hear it.
You can come to our website, themotts.ca, go to our sound off section and drop a comment in there. If you only caught part of the show, we do post it on our listen page as well. Thanks to all our guests this week. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Have a great week.